Mahi, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Now, you have a very, very interesting background. Currently, do you want to explain what your role is? And then I'm going to give people a bit of an interesting insight to other things that you've done.
Okay. So my current role, and is my current role for about the next 4.5 days, is the I'm the national service lead for cost and commercial management quantity surveying at Arcadis, based in Brisbane.
And you lead that whole team, and you've built it, I think, from 4 to 25 people. Is that correct over the last few years?
Kind of less than that. So 9 years ago, I joined Arcadis to start their cost management business in Australia. And there was two of us from day one. I basically grabbed a guy called Neil Gall, who was who was effectively my number two when I was at Aquenta / Jacobs. And I had this opportunity. I thought I'd handle this on my own. So I kind of dragged Neil kicking and screaming with me. We've grown it from two people back in 2017 to about 25, 26 people as of now. And absolutely looking to recruit in the next few weeks as well. So the team's going to get bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is. Now, whilst you were doing that, I mean, how long have you lived in Brisbane for?
Since 2010, so 16 years now.
So tell us a little bit about your story before that and sort of how you emerged, and then we'll get a bit of the Queensland context.
All right. So I finished uni about 98 and got my first job. So I was actually went to university in Preston, which for those people who don't know or care, that's in the north of England. And I got my first role as a graduate down in London. So I worked in London for about 5-6 years, then moved back to Manchester, worked in Manchester for about 5 years, where I was incidentally at a company at AYH in Manchester, which was owned by Arcadis at the time. But, basically, the day that I joined AYH was the day we got bought by Arcadis. So it was effectively Arcadis for 5 years without deliberately making that choice. And then GFC hit, which in the UK is just known as the recession or the market crash. Australia is very good at abbreviating everything. So you say GFC in the UK, nobody has a scuba idea what you're saying. So basically the recession. Worked in that for 2 years. We'd gone from an office in Manchester from about 28 people down to about 12. So it was, you know, blood on the walls, people leaving left, right, and centre, being made redundant. And what I was doing was still working, but I was still, you know, delivering for clients. We were still bringing in work, but it was pretty, you know, pretty grim. So
yeah.
So we took that opportunity. I came home one day, and we'd always. No, I had a conversation with my wife. We always talked about moving to Australia. And I said, yeah, I think I'm done. Let's look at Australia. She had the forms filled and printed out and filled the very, very next day. And then we were away at the races. So 6 months later, maybe just a little bit longer, we moved to Brisbane. And incidentally, moving here, I joined Mitchell Brantman, which is a much smaller business to kind of what I was used to working in. But they gave me an opportunity to move across, which was great. I'll always be thankful for that. But actually went from being a director in Manchester down to a senior cost manager in Brisbane. And then bounced around a little bit because the Australian market is a little bit different, quite a lot different to what it is in the UK, and particularly how the QS role works here.
Yeah.
It took me a while to try and find my feet and work out how the industry kind of worked, and took me a few years through a couple of different companies to kind of move back up to that director senior level.
So I think that's a good thing, because we're going to talk about what you did. So if anybody who's listening will be aware soon, is that you started a very large networking event that is quite principal in Brisbane, and we'll have a chat about that. But I think it's around the QSs. So in the UK, QSs are actually, it's certified. You actually have a whole way of going through, don't you? It's a bit like a registration for an architect.
It is similar here, although there are some nuances to it. So in the UK, and it may have changed now because it has been, let's face it, 25, 26 years since I finished my degree, things may be slightly different. In fact, they should be slightly different. If they're still the same, there's a problem. So I did a quantity surveying degree, which you can't do in Australia. You do a construction management degree, and then you've got a minor or a major in quantity surveying. So that's slightly different. And then in the UK, everything is RICS, the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. And generally, unless you are a really, really small, like small SME, generally all the medium-sized players, all the bigger firms, even the contractors, all push for their graduates to become professionally qualified. So generally, you finish university, and within 2 to 3 years, most people are generally chartered. Here, it's the same. The RICS is here, so it's the same. The AIQS also is obviously a more Australianized version of that, more local. But it's not the same push to become professionally qualified as it is in the UK. There are people who've got their entire career without being professionally qualified. Because it's just not the same. Honestly, the market works a bit differently here.
Yeah. And I think that's it, because we also do find quite a lot of leading QSs are from the UK as well. And I think that is because
I would say that all the best QSs come from the UK, and that's going to say a lot of Australians, but yeah, I don't care.
Anyway, so all right, well, that's very interesting. So, well, you obviously landed here. You knew absolutely nobody in Brisbane. So explain to us a little bit about, we'll go into that a bit later, of where the market was then, how you've seen Brisbane go. But tell us a little bit about why and what property leaders, Brisbane, I better be getting the terminology incorrect. Can you tell us a little bit about why you started that and how it all got going?
Yeah, well, when I left Manchester, I had a similar networking group in Manchester for very similar reasons. I'd moved from London back up into Manchester in a more senior role, and I knew I needed to expand kind of my network. And that time, that was called Young Entrepreneurs in Property Manchester, because it's based on a similar group in London. And then when I moved here to the other side of the world, I realized that I don't know anybody. I've got no clients. I've got no connections. And in Manchester, I built a bit of a reputation of being able to win work, and you do that through networking. You do that through building relationships. So I started back then. This is going back away now, like 15 years ago. I started the earliest version of what became Property Leaders Brisbane, Young Entrepreneurs in Property Brisbane, and did that 2 or 3 years. Started building the network mainly because I knew that I needed to build that network of people. And there are two ways of doing it. You can either, and bear in mind, I'm taking 2 or 3 steps down. Back down to like a senior cost manager level. You can either build a network through delivering work, which can take time and take even longer if you get pigeonholed in a particular sector, or you're in a major project for 5 years, it does take a while to build that network. Or you can do something that's a bit more expansive across the market, which was the original motivation. So get a committee of people around me of architects, project managers, people in other professions, people who I can build relationships with them, and then use their networks. And that's kind of where it started, until about probably 3-4 years later. We rebranded it to Property Leaders Brisbane, mainly because I realized I couldn't no longer call myself young, and I wasn't really entrepreneurial because I was working for companies. So, but I did work in property. So that's why we rebranded it to Property Leaders Brisbane.
Well, do we want to tell, for anybody who's listening who doesn't know what it is? Because unless you're in Brisbane and you're in the industry, and some people may not know. So tell us a little bit about what it is and what the extent of how many things that you actually now do as well.
So, well, it's changed a bit over the years, but predominantly it's a networking group. It's about building a professional community in the industry. And when you look at all the other kind of events that are on, you've got the developer doing events, you've got Property Council of Australia, you've got UDIA, and then several other kind of niche, like Chambers of Commerce, all these events. Most of them are, they're either membership-based, or you've got to pay, and generally even with membership base, you've still got to pay for end events, right? So the idea of Property Leaders was to do free events, find not have an agenda, because as soon as you have members, people feel like they can direct your interests. So like PCA, for example, is very, very developer driven, right? That's its audience. And UDIA is slightly different, and then you've got the QMCA and you've got the AC. You've got all these different bodies that have got members who drive agendas based on them, their members' goals. We didn't want that. We wanted to be able to have open conversations. So the events are generally free. We generally got an architect's office who've got a decent space who can host, or a contractor's office who can host like 70, 80, 100 people. And they basically provide the space. They, they put on some food and drinks, and then we organise the event in terms of, like, oh, is it a panel of speakers? Is it a keynote speaker? various different formats. We try and have a bit of fun with it. We try not to make sure it's all very, very formal and very, very, you know, again, agenda driven. We try and just have a bit of fun with it, because we think if it's fun, people will get more out of it, and people will engage with the topic of the conversation a little bit more. So even if we're being a bit sarcastic with stuff. And then we had COVID. So we used to do like probably five, maybe six events a year. And then amongst that, we probably about 6, 7 years ago, we started doing the First Thursday Club, which was just basically networking drinks. There's no speakers. We started off with no sponsors. So ironically, turnout was very, very small, probably about 15, 20 people. And then eventually, because we didn't want to have sponsors, we didn't want it to be just about, you know, come get a free drink. We wanted it to be a decent conversation. Yeah. And then after a few years of low turnout, we then said, well, let's try sponsors for a bit, who just come out and put some money behind the bar and we'll kind of see what happens. And then ironically, we have a lot more people turning up now. So what do you know? People in Brisbane do like a free drink.
It is the thing, like, you know, you look at Tox does something on a quarterly basis, right? And that is pay for your own drinks, but somebody puts the food on. I think what's amazing in Queensland is I find Queenslanders are just happy to have a drink and chat. They don't necessarily, running industry events ourselves, like with other sort of groups, I was just amazed. It was like, no, I don't really listen to somebody and have a, like, do that. We just want to have a chat. And, you know, there seems to be quite a Queensland versus in Sydney and Melbourne. Generally, if you do an event, you'll have a topic and there'll be a talking and there'll be some networking pre and a bit of networking after. And I agree with you, because the PCA is a bit like that. It's like a little bit, and there's a like very big tables and lots of talking, and you kind of take people if you want to potentially build, but I don't see the same part. Whereas I think from what you've done is create something that's regular. So sometimes people make it. You don't. There's generally probably hundreds of people there at any one time. What, 50, 200 people at any one event?
It ranges. It depends whether you've got, you know, school holidays or industry, you know, things, other things that are happening in the industry. So it just kind of ebb and flow. But generally, the last few events is probably anywhere between 60 to 80 to 100 people. And if some people turn up, they have one drink and then they leave, but then other people turn up later. So we don't, you know, we're not doing a register to see exactly who's there at any point. But it is a lot more popular. And we did that. And then that and the bigger events stopped during COVID. So then we started the Shovel podcast, which was just about getting good, you know, good guests on and talk about what's happening in the industry. And sometimes a bit more expensive about what's happening like nationally, but generally very, very focused on Brisbane. That's been really good. We've had some really good feedback on that. That's still continuing. We're still doing the First Thursday. We did a big event end of last year, and I think there's two more events coming up this year. So the bigger events have taken a while to get back up running, kind of post-COVID. Yeah. And we put on probably a lot more into First Thursday and the podcast. But we are, you know, I'm stepping down. So it's now the committee are planning on doing some bigger events. In fact, there's one actually, I'm not sure when this is going to go out, but there's actually one this week that we're doing with the Lebo. So the bigger events are coming back.
Yeah, great to see. And that's where it really, I think that's the great thing too. It's getting it out there. People do want to connect. It's just giving them a forum to do that. So, and I think it's one of those things that a lot of people, I think it's one, it's created a connection, and we had a bit of a chat about it at the last event. You know, even though you will be now moving back to the UK, it's going to be something that will continue. And as you've mentioned, you know, you're going to have the right people on that committee too, who have the same interest and want to drive it and keep moving it forward. And I think you've done that. You've got a nice representation across the industry as well. And it's very, very important. And I think as, you know, QSs, you're trying to build relationships with PMs and architects and others, and you know, you sort of understand the dynamics of who needs to work with who. It's great for, you know, those who are builders and are coming in and trying to build their business and, you know, wanting to meet those people versus just knocking on a door or randomly calling people.
I find there's, you know, personally, you know, some, particularly when I've joined a new business and I talk about the stuff we're doing at Property Leaders, the first question usually comes out. One of the questions is, and it's usually given by somebody who doesn't do business development and doesn't do relationship building, right? And they're like, well, how much work have you won out of Property Leaders? And it's like, well, directly, probably not much. But in terms of me building a relationship with that person or that person or that person, and then they've introduced me to a client. What was the catalyst? Was it property leaders? Was it the relationship that I've built kind of through that group and outside of that group? And then they've made an introduction, and then I've had to build a relationship with that client. So you could join all the dots and say it comes back to property leaders, but it's never that hard and fast. So it's about relationship building. And anybody who's turned up to those events, you can spot them a mile off, who are the business development people who were there to see how many leads can I get out of this event. It's like, yeah, you're not here for the right reasons, because if you're here to build relationships, you will get opportunities ultimately, but it's not overnight. You're not going to do it today. You're probably not going to do it the next two or three events. It's being consistent in that approach. And that, for me, that's what business development is. And
well, it is about relationship building. I mean, there's many parts on psychology and building those things. It is about trust, right? So, it depends if you're doing it in a digital format or relationship format, right? In this industry, it is all around relationships. The projects and the fees are so high that those come through relationships. It's not, just do this. Everybody always thinks, let's do marketing. Marketing's just about familiarity, continuing that on, keeping front of mind. In the same way, calling somebody on a regular basis is just keeping in their mind, in front of the mind, something comes up and it happens.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. It's one of those parts where, in the industry, as you say, it's the people who don't know how to BD or, it depends. We've all got to go. You kind of go, right, we need to make this out of building different relationships. And sometimes, like the other day, I think I've been there for like 2 years. And somebody's like, how do you guys not know? It's like, we just haven't exchanged cards. Like, I know we see each other, we do that. But is that relevant? It's not about just, collecting cards and calling people and not doing it. It's about understanding them and their business and what can you do, and quid pro quo. And I think that's the great thing about these events too. Yes, there'll be an element of what do you do and people going is, but also there is an element of people know each other. And if somebody has, like this morning, I open up and there's somebody that I have relationships with who's just referring me to somebody else. Hey, this person needs this help. And it comes through those relationships, those referrals, or getting that opportunity, then doing a good job and then building that, continuing to build that reputation, particularly in the Queensland market, I think, too, versus Sydney and Melbourne. It's all relationships in property. But I would say particularly for Brisbane, it's very hard to get into Brisbane if you don't have relationships.
It's very hard to get into Brisbane when you're in Brisbane if you don't have relationships. So I'll give you a bit of a story. And this is raised by somebody I know in the industry, and they'll remain anonymous because they still have to work in this. Industry. But they gave me they called me out of the blue, and we talk relatively regularly, but called me suddenly, which is unlike them. And they said, Matt, I'm just wondering, how long have you been in Brisbane now? I'm like, 16 years. And he said, of those 16 years, how many major Queensland government projects have you won? And I went, and I had to think about it. And other than winning some business cases on big projects that may have not progressed any further, I realized that probably haven't, in terms of not directly for government, right? Mm. We've worked on other projects that have been like kind of sponsored by government, but the client, the vehicle delivering isn't necessarily government, like more private developer. And I'm like, that's interesting. And they said, I've just had this kind of moment that it's still all the same people winning the same work. And that shows two things. One, it shows that the power of relationships in the market, right? And there are a lot of companies, whether it's architects, project managers, QSs, who've been in the market for a long time. And there are some companies that just get that repeat kind of work. It's like they're just always on the list. But then that feeds against the narrative a little bit that sometimes comes out of public office, which is, we want the best and the brightest. We want to mix things up. We want different players. But you don't actually necessarily see that coming through. So it was an interesting observation, maybe unfair, but in terms of experience, it does point to Queensland is probably more prone to, Southeast Queensland in particular, is probably more prone to, you've got to have those kind of relationships. And if you are not in the market, if you don't have people who've been in the market for a long time who know senior people, then it is very, very difficult to win the big stuff, let's say. There's plenty of work out there. Plenty of work that you can win. But yeah.
It's very interesting because sometimes people from Queensland go, oh, we couldn't make Melbourne work because it's very much, you know, you need to be in it. And I think there is an element.
It's the same thing. It's the stuff that Queenslanders are complaining about in Melbourne, that's just what Melbourneites are complaining about in Queensland.
Which I find, but at the end of the day, it is. I mean, if we talk about it from picking strategic leaders and picking people, I think there is two parts. You can have people who have established relationships, or you can have people who are actually good at building relationships and good at delivering as well. You know, put yourself in that. I know you're talking about one client, you know, a government client or what that is, but at the same time, it's how you.
Well, a government client that is delivering most of the construction pipeline over the next 2 years, right?
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, particularly if you're right, absolutely on that side of things. So let's that's probably a good transition now into it. You know, we're sitting here in the 18th of May 2026. You're about to leave the country, but you obviously write a quality report on costs and things like that. We had an interesting discussion on how Brisbane pre-COVID really experienced a lot lower rate of increase. And then through COVID, that's changed. And obviously now sort of where we're at, and we're about to lead into 2030. So first, you want to give us a bit of an insight into how the difference in the Brisbane market, but also the costs has been.
Yeah. Okay. So kind of deep you want to go with this, because there's all kind of analysis that I've done on this historically. Generally, from about 2000 to, say, 2020, so just before, or 2019, just before COVID kind of really hit in Australia and really hit in Queensland, construction costs on an average year-on-year went up by about 1 to 1.5% per year, right? Really, really low. If you went and asked most people, and I've done this, I've done boardroom lunches and presentations where I've asked the audience, I said, what would you say year-on-year average inflation has been up to this point? Most people in their head are thinking 3 and 4%, right? It wasn't. It was like, and this kind of shows how quiet the market has been, right? And it actually, so I think it's like 1.6, 1.7 over that 2000 to 2019. If you go from 2010 to 2019, so post GFC to just before COVID, it actually drops even further. So it's actually closer to 1% rather than being 1.6%.
Yeah, right.
And that kind of shows you how quiet the market has been. So when I came here in 2010, my observation was I'd actually moved to the slowest market I've ever worked in, because in the UK, you used to peaks and troughs, you used to boom and bust, you have like 6 to 8 years of it all boom, and then there's a recession, it drops off for a few years. Queensland hasn't had that in 10 years, right? And well, probably close to 12, 13. So we're now in 2026 and we've got the promise of all this health work, all the Olympics work, and anything we need to do on schools and anything we need to do on infrastructure, right? But just before all that, you had COVID. And in the middle of COVID, we also had the war in Ukraine as well. So everything kind of stopped. Costs didn't increase massively, although there was a big increase with materials. But because workload actually dropped quite a lot, because those couple of years, 2021, 2022, there wasn't a massive amount of activity because it was just projects that were in flight, people trying to
deliver.
Yeah,
okay.
You had that whole thing down in New South Wales where people couldn't travel to site because they were too far away. And it's like, well, where do you get your labor from? So you had all that kind of stuff going on. 2023, that's when the borders opened. We had border closures up in Queensland. There was only WA in Queensland that had border closures.
New South Wales did too, but being a Victorian coming up to Queensland, there was constant, but as in it really did, it opened up a lot more. We forget this. We forget that only a few years ago we're a federal country and we never thought about that. And what that actually meant was, states could close borders to each other. And suddenly it was like, oh, my God. I mean, I lived right on the border of New South Wales and Queensland.
Yeah.
And it would be half of my life would be quite impossible if I couldn't go south.
Yes. Yeah. So 2023, the borders opened and there was only Queensland and Western Australia that had border closures. Costs went through the roof in 2023. They went up by about 14.5% in Queensland. And it was something similar in WA. In WA, I think I'd have to go and recheck this, but it was like 16, 17% in WA. right? So just in that year, and that was driven by borders opening, projects restarting, material costs going through the roof, because all of a sudden there was like this increased demand, labor costs being an issue. But there were a lot of insolvencies as well, which creates another impact on labor and contractor availability. So cost just went, but there was only all this work. 2023 was a boom year because everything went up like that. All of a sudden, after 2 years, we're like, oh my God, we're so busy. Cost went through the roof. And then over the last 2-3 years, things have kind of, they're not normalized. They were still high. They dropped down to like anywhere between 5% and 7%. Like per year, or
which is very high if you've been used to 10 years of 1%.
Exactly. So 2022, 2023 was like the 14.5 range. 2024 was probably about 5 and 7. Interestingly, most QSs, including ourselves, were thinking that was going to continue to 2025. I think last year it was actually dropped down to about 3%, right? So it dropped off massively. So you didn't have the material cost increases that you'd had in the previous couple of years. But I think it was also a reflection of how light the market was. There wasn't a massive amount of work. There was still all this promise, you know, the Olympics are moving forward. Here are the venues we're going to go and build. We're going to build all the hospitals. A lot of positive sentiment, because if you look on the previous 15 years, that sentiment hadn't been there, right? We suddenly had all the sentiment, but the work still wasn't hitting the market. So inflation, cost inflation for construction costs dropped massively to about 3% last year. I think this year it's likely to be a similar kind of thing, that kind of like 3%. But then as soon as the work starts really hitting, as soon as they move through the ECI process for the stadium, the National Aquatic Centre, and you've got all the minor venues with contractors being appointed, and then you've got the layer of hospitals, and you've got the layer of transport, and anything else we need to build, like schools and housing in particular, hotels, that's just going to have this cumulative effect that's going to ramp up costs over the next few years. So the prediction is that over to 2026 is probably going to be 3-4%, I would guess. In fact, I could go and look, if I had the mind to, I could go and look at the ABS data for Q1, and that would start giving us an indication. But moving forward, probably into 2027, 2028, you're going to start seeing costs go back up to that 6-8%, because demand's going to, there's going to be very little capacity in the market, and people are going to have to pay more money to secure pipelines, secure contractors.
So let's talk about that in the particular parts of Queensland. I mean, obviously coming from Victoria and New South Wales, there's a lot more builders. As you said, a lot of people went in. We're recording this just, you know, after, but we're still in the midst of potentially what this is going to look like, fuel, right? Which is obviously supplies. You know, I know plumbers and people can't get pipes, or they've gone up 30%. Yep. Most of the trade materials are going up between 15-30% just in the pure costs themselves. Not even get
exactly what we saw, kind of exactly what we saw in COVID as well. Yeah.
And then we're about a quarter of a mil, 300,000 people in trades alone in mm-hmm. Queensland alone, I believe.
It's not just trades, it's construction managers, it's architects, it's engineers, it's everybody who contributes to delivering a construction project. It's, 300,000.
So we're really short. We don't even have somewhere to put those people, because everybody wants their 600-metre, you know, block. So now we're starting to see rezoning for a bit more multi-res and, you know, more high-density living around, which Queenslanders have to get used to. We've obviously got all of this infrastructure that needs to be built. There's how many tier one builders we've really got? We've got very, very few up here as well.
Now, so you've probably got, and if you're looking at the tier ones who kind of operate on both infrastructure and property side, you've probably got 5, maybe 6. One of those is, you know, in my view, is for Olympics, has already been taken out the mix, because Langoroku are the delivery, you know, the delivery partner for the Olympics. They're not actually building anything. They're the delivery partner. So they're not charged with actually building individual venues. They're managing the delivery of the whole program. Alongside Geica. So that's one tier. That's not to say they're not going to build anything else. They could still build hospitals and all the rest of it, right? Should they have mind to. But that's one contractor out. So you've probably left down to 4 or 5 major tier ones who are going to be in the market. And some of those are actively positioning for venues and hospitals, and some of those are not actively positioning. So, it's a very, very it's a very, very constrained market, particularly with that tier one phase. So what will happen is you'll end up with some of the larger tier two stepping into the bottom end of that tier one range, which is probably what they, some of them want to do that. Other contractors don't want to do unionized work. So they're going to stay out of it. It does give you this, there is a risk then that if you end up with smaller tier twos stepping into that bottom end of the tier one, they don't necessarily have the infrastructure and the processes and the, you know, and a lot of that support you would get with a tier one. So are they going to overstretch themselves? And if they overstretch themselves, they could potentially put themselves out of business. There's always a risk of that when you've got contractors taking on work. Yeah. It's kind of beyond their capability. And then I've heard arguments before that, oh, when are we going to get a tier one from Sydney relocating up into Brisbane? It's like, well, that could happen, but we talked about it before. If you don't have the relationships, how on earth are you, you know, how can you possibly win work? A tier one is not just going to open up the doors. And even if they did, they're still going to try and rely on the same trade market that's available already in the market. So it's not the trades, you know, it's not the main contractors, which in that, you know, that's obviously a concern in terms of how constrained that market is. But it's also the trades. We still only have so many form workers. We still only have so many rail companies. So if you can't transport trades up here, and that's always been the argument from government and from other companies, is that, oh, well, we'll pay premiums and we'll attract workforce up. It's like, well, that only works in part. That is not going to solve the problem. And all you're doing is robbing Peter to pay Paul as well.
And that's sort of what we predict is going to be the biggest problem looking ahead. Yep. So it's great. We've had a change in government who are now pro-development, trying to take down, dealing with some of the, you know, union side of things, trying to get developments through. The biggest constraint is probably, you know, as we know, I'm from Melbourne and, you know, we sort of look at what's happened to Melbourne. Yes, COVID, but also a heap of infrastructure has been being built all at one time.
Yes.
And then the debt to pay that. I mean, we all know, even looking at the federal government, we're in billions of dollars of debt. So, and then this is, and I think that was why they put a lot of the hospitals, they re-looked at it, didn't they? To sort of just take out of competing against each other to actually sort of be able to delay them over. Now,
I think it was a bit of both. I think part of it was they did go to market for a lot of those hospitals, and, you know, we've been involved in at least one of those. And I think they were just struggling to get the budgets to stack up with what the market was saying it was going to cost to build.
Mm.
So there was a bit of a reset. So I think some of it was budget driven. But then what happened, and this was under the previous government, there was a drive to, well, let's get the hospitals out to market before the Olympics. So that was government's like Hunger Games environment with government departments of like, let's get the market secured for our program and we'll kick the can down the road for the Olympics and anything else that kind of follows. Not necessarily best in industry, best in government kind of behaviors. So I think the reset has allowed them to think about, well, when's the best time to deliver all this? But then you've also got to bear in mind is always one of the challenges with infrastructure. It is highly politicized. It's tied to government commitments and election commitments. So they're like, oh, no, we said we would deliver this hospital by this date. We have to deliver it. And then regardless of what's happening elsewhere. So you've always got that friction and that tension, which is good because it drives development, particularly big social infrastructure. But it also creates that, you know, that combination of competing commitments and you've only got so much workforce that can actually deliver it.
So I'm going to ask you a question then. If you could redesign, you get to leave the country. In a very short period. Like if Matthew could create anything and said, right, this is my word, this is what I reckon we could do, you could do to fix this, guys, mic drop, them out. What needs to be potentially done?
I've been asked similar things before. The unfortunate thing is, and I've used this line before, there's not a silver bullet, there's not a Harry Potter spell which can change all this, right? The whole industry needs a bit of a redesign from how it operates culturally, the contracts that we use, how procurement is undertaken. And there's probably about 15 different levers that need to get pulled to move the market, right?
What are some of those levers?
So one of those levers would be about how work comes to market. It would be about pipeline. It would be, yeah, we can talk about government as being one entity. But the truth of it is there are all these different departments that have got all these different commitments. All that needs to be joined up in its thinking. And it needs to be a case of, right, what is the most important things? What needs to get delivered first? And it needs to be phased in such a way, because this is the problem with, like, particularly from a UK perspective, when there's kind of like boom and bust, because there's too much work in the market, costs go up, it can't go on any longer, things fold, the market falls, everything kind of resets. Queensland have never, Australia has not really had a recession since, probably about 2008, 2009, and even then that wasn't even a big drop either, right?
Yeah.
So in certainly in the last 20 years, it's been, it hasn't had that much of a reset. So costs continue to go up. So there needs to be, if we need to deliver all this infrastructure, and I think the way that the government is doing it now, and GEICA with how they're trying to engage with market, looking at ECIs and more, GMP type driven pricing, which is probably on a more collaborative basis, is good. Could it go further? Yes, it could. But certainly understanding about being clear on the pipeline of, we are going to deliver these things by this date and engage with the market and get the market locked in for that pipeline, that surety for the market. And that, when you've got that surety and you're going to be building Hospital A and Hospital B and Hospital C on like kind of these dates over the next 5 years, that's when you can start looking at investment in things like modern methods of construction, modularization, because that, for MMC to work, DFMA, which is Design for Manufactured Assembly, that works when you know what you are building for the next 5-10 years. It doesn't work when you only know you're building this one project in the next 2 years.
Yeah.
Because you need a pipeline. That's why the car industry does it, right? Because they know they're building out so many units over the years. Now, construction is not the car industry, but if we know what we're building, and particularly when you think about stuff that can be modularized, things that is repeatable, like hospitals, like build to rent apartments, schools, even some of the venues that we're talking about for the Olympics, right? There can be a repeatable component. So if you designed it all in such a way that you could just get all that out there, and then the market would almost create itself based on that certainty. So when Queensland Productivity Commission did their report, we inputted into that in terms of some recommendations. It was all built about surety of pipeline. And unfortunately, from a government perspective, when you're locked into 4-year cycles, you try and get everything done in the first 2.5 years, because then it's about showing that you've moved the needle. And then for the next year and a half, you're almost back into an election cycle again, so nothing else gets done. So it is. I understand how difficult it is from a government perspective, because they want to think long term. But the nature of our election cycles means that they actually struggle to, because planning a pipeline of work for the next 10 years doesn't really work. But if a new government comes in, they generally changed it anyway, because that wasn't their idea. So there's a lot of that which needs to be almost ring-fenced.
Well, and it is quite interesting. And that's, I've had this conversation even on the weekend with somebody about government decisions and things like that. And it is political, and it's great that we have 4 years so we get balances, but it also means, compared to other economies across the world that have that longevity, they can play the chess game. They can play the 10, 20-year game.
Yeah.
That's fine, and it's going to be built. You meet people in some middle ages, I'm really going to make this into a whole thing. 20 years later, it is.
All you've got to do is look at something like Cross River Rail and look at how many business cases were done, generally because every time there was a change of government, they had a different idea or put it back for a business case to make sure they were getting value. So there was more money. Anybody who was involved in a business case during Cross River Rail made an absolute mozza, because nothing ever got built for like 5-6 years. So... And that was part of it, is that, the UK still has that, talk about the UK as a comparison point for a minute. They still have those same challenges. But if something has generally been started, the next government will see it through, because there's already been investment, there's already been money spent. And unless they've campaigned on the fact, we're not going to go and build that, because that's a terrible idea, unless that's what they've campaigned on, they generally keep it going, because industry can't cope with all these shocks of it's on, it's off, it's on, it's off. And that, and we're still in this point of where politics has become certain. We get into politics now. You should never talk about religion and politics. I'm sure we'll get onto religion in a minute. But politics has become so polarized that an incoming government can never say, that's actually a good idea, we're going to continue with it. It's a case of like, no, we need to throw a load of mud at this, the incumbents didn't have a clue what they were doing, we're going to change, oh, it's going to be better. And then if there's another change of government, it's just the reverse again. So it's that's part of the problem. The polarization of politics has made that everything is on the table for discussion and debate, rather than saying, that's actually quite a good idea, we're going to continue with that.
What was interesting, I asked somebody who was on the program who's an urban designer in that way, urban planner, I should say, and we had that conversation. And on national level, you'll hear that come out soon. And very interesting, I asked her, how do you find that from a planning perspective of when you're working in a country where there's very short-term thinking versus long-term thinking in other countries and what they can achieve in that? And I mean, we just have to be realistic to the system. I think the thing is that, you, as you've mentioned, according to Matt, these are the things that we could do to fix it. You can see it. And it's quite interesting because as a business person, you sit there and you go, if this was a business, this is what you would be doing. You wouldn't be having departments fighting each other because you'd be losing money. You wouldn't be like, let's just do everything and compete against each other. You'd be like, right, we've got this much money, we're going to do this. But it is often as the taxpayer, you're like, excellent. We've got a bunch of people who are not thinking like business people. They're just thinking like people who need to be voted in again.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily help us. So there's some of the levers. I mean, where do you sort of see, it sounds like to me, the system may need to be overhauled. Let's be realistic, though. Systems don't overhaul.
No. Right? It's never been overhauled in the last 25 years, so why would we do it now? Yeah.
So nothing's gonna significantly change. So what does this look like, do you think, for the next, up to 2032? How do those in the industry actually prepare? Because I 100% agree with you. I'll take a step back. The modular is a big conversation. And we had this in an earlier podcast where, from somebody from Adelaide, where why can't we build houses like cars, or why can't we build them? And we can. And it might stack up in a regional part, but it's now making it stack up in an urban part. And as you said, it's the modular part of building. Thing is, we have to get the designers on board to thinking.
There's
the infrastructure to build it too.
There's two or three sides with it. One is, you need the designers on board. There's also public opinion, because when you hear modular, people think IKEA flat pack. They think porch cabins, right?
It's very true. Changing the perception.
They don't actually see what good modular can look like. The other side of it is as well, because we've worked for a few government departments, not in Queensland, but down in New South Wales, who have been on the track of, we want to do modular. But everything ties back to a business case, right? And the business cases usually have not been prepared with modular in mind. They've usually been prepared in terms of traditional benchmarking and like historically how these assets would be constructed. And then when they go down the modular route, they then get a contractor on board and they look at modular. And it usually ends up being more expensive than tradition, right? Maybe quicker on site, right? Maybe less defects, but the maybe bit is the bit that people can, because it's like, well, unless we know it's going to be less defects, unless we know it's going to be quicker, then we're just kind of like guessing. We need to see the proof, and we never get to the point of actually always demonstrating it, particularly on bigger assets, right? There's plenty of smaller examples in Australia where it's worked, but we haven't done it on anything of like scale, like big build-to-rent or big schools or big hospitals. And then they look at the business case and, like, well, this is more expensive. And we were hoping it was going to be cheaper. So, and then it just kind of like, it'd be easy just to build it traditionally, right? That's what the natural default is too. But again, it comes back to that long-term thinking, because the first one, the first car that was ever constructed on a production line would have been the most expensive cars ever made, right? And it's only by the time you get to like the 1,000th unit, it's now significantly cheaper, and therefore significantly cheaper for consumers. Mm. If you think about photovoltaic cells, like solar cells, when they first started coming out, and I worked on a project in 1999, 2000 that was using PVs, like to quite a scale in the project, ridiculously expensive, right? Like prohibitively expensive. And we're now at the point where they're significantly cheaper, because they've been a production run, they've got better at manufacturing it, there's more available in the market, which that all drives costs down. So it's just, simple economics. Modular is the same thing, is that the first one will be more expensive. But if you can build like another 10, 20, 30 of these, you'll see the cost of it coming down. And that's where your eye needs to be. But we as an industry, not just from a government perspective, but even developers, they only ever build the next project that's directly in front of them. So they want to see the returns on the first project. And that's not how modular works. You get the returns on the, not even the second or the third, it's the fourth, fifth, sixth, tenth. And it gets cheaper to the point where you just know what the cost is going to be. And you don't necessarily have 20, 30% worth of variations, right? And nobody wants variations on a project. But when you're signing off on a contract figure, right, it's very difficult to think what the benefits might be without having them demonstrated directly to you on that project. Guarantees. So they look at it and say, no, it's more expensive. We'll just go back to traditional.
So who is doing it well across the globe? Who is doing modular and has made it work? And what do they have to build to do it to?
Well, no surprises, Sweden. They're doing it very well. They invented IKEA, but they're doing it very well. UK is, I think, is significantly ahead of Australia, but again, could be a lot further ahead as well. That's still got a lot of way to go, but it is further ahead in terms of at least moving a lot of this stuff forward. Japan, Germany, you know, there are some countries out there. I mean, I think
I may be
misrepresenting the stat, but Japan, like 70% of its housing is modular.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I had this conversation. I think the interesting thing with modular is that we kind of have this thing in Australia, we all want something unique. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're talking to someone, I can't have IKEA. That's ridiculous. It's all going to be bespoke. It sounds like to me, though, the countries you've mentioned where it is doing well, they've already got a strength in manufacturing. They've already got that. And that's what they, if we look at this from a international trade perspective,
yeah,
as well, we specialize in things. So this is why it's interesting talking to somebody in Adelaide where you've got all of this manufacturing built. Mm. Right, it was already built for that. They're thinking it's like, well, why can't we do the same but transfer it over to something new? So I think it's that, as you said, you're not going to make it in first, but it probably as a country or as either you are probably a builder needs to build this and needs to be actually probably a tier one builder is going to need to build, sounds like that, a bit of that base infrastructure or a few of them. And then it may start to build up.
Lango Rock actually did it in the UK. They actually, they built it's like an aircraft hangar. It is huge, specifically for modular. But it's taken them, I don't know, guessing a little bit, 3, 4, maybe even 5 years before that has actually started making any kind of return.
Yeah, right.
So the level of investment into that, and that's with a pipeline of work as well. The level of investment that goes into that kind of shows you. So you do need big investments. And the bit of the investment also needs to come from developers and needs to come from government who are saying, yes, we think this is a good idea. I've always campaigned that government need to start off being the driving force, because particularly in the market we're in now in Brisbane and Australia, a lot of the work is public sector. They almost need to drive the market and create the pipeline and create the conditions for people to invest and people to create the manufacturing capability to respond to that pipeline. And at the moment, it's still a case of, well, there's a pipeline of work and we just need the private sector to invest in this. So, well, the private sector isn't going to invest in something with no surety to. And that's the barrier. So I do believe government need to drive it. And that's what happened in the UK. Government drove programs of work entirely built around modular to create the conditions.
And it's interesting because I sort of look at it and I think, okay, if you've got a country where you know you don't have a housing crisis or you need to build stuff, you know that cost is continuously going up by 5, 6, 7%, even if it's down at the 3%, you've either got to open up the borders and let more trades in, which is potentially, I know that's a federal thing, not a state. You've got to then, you can nick from each state. So, you know, Victoria's a bit cooler.
I'm going to get you so far. Yeah,
that's right.
After COVID, there was a massive the interstate migration from Victoria to Queensland was insane. Right, it was ridiculous. And then after two or three, and they all moved up to the coast. And then a lot of them realized it was difficult to get a job on the coast. And they realized it was in Queensland in summer, it's really freaking hot. So they all moved back. Well, they didn't all move back. There was a lot of interstate migration the other way when they realized necessarily Queensland wasn't there. Yeah.
Whereas right now, I would say to everybody, move back. There is a pipeline of enormous work. As we said, we're at a massive deficit, and that is not going to necessarily change in Victoria as quickly. It's going to take a long time to come back. But essentially then you kind of go, well, if you know this is and you need to invest in industry, I mean, it is a very local industry. We're not exporting here. We're not doing anything. We're building for ourselves. That has to be one of the things that might potentially.
Yeah,
I agree. It's going to have to be government. But the thing is, everybody talks about modular. And it's like, oh, the future is modular. And this, and it hasn't gone anywhere for years. And it's great for you to explain what that is. Yeah, absolutely. On the scale, size and scale. And I mean, in it actually banking up, which is essentially you need to create spaces to be able to do something to repetitively do it. Again, though, when I say the designers, they have to know how to build for that and design for that in mind.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of learning in that. You know, as I said, we had an architect on who specializes in that. And once you start to learn how to do it the way you're designing, I will be very interested in, though, how the effects of AI and technology is potentially going to also affect this, but the industry in general. What's your sort of thoughts?
Oh, that's an expansive question. Well, some of the stats I've seen, and again, this is I've not seen anything from Australia, but from UK, I think there was a survey that said 70% of builders were all saying that they're adopting AI in some shape or form, right? Now, that could be they've integrated Copilot into their Microsoft suite, right? It could be that. It could be more. It could be building apps using Claude and all that kind of thing. So there are different levels. I think AI is going to work from a professional services perspective. It's certainly going to change things. It's going to make things smarter. It's going to make things quicker. We've got Copilot now in Arcadis, and I no longer need to remind myself how to do a pivot table. It will do it for me. I just tell it what I want, and it does it. It's incredible. So there are going to be a lot of things that. What would have been a bit of a barrier or would have taken a while before, you're going to be able to do it in a matter of minutes. Workflows in terms of like contract documentation, contract administration, all that is going to get quicker because AI is going to have this way that's going to do a lot of it automatically and make for us humans decision making a lot easier. So that's going to have a multiplying effect. But at the end of the day, AI still gets driven at this moment in time by people on sites. Right, AI is not necessarily going to change that, unless, of course, it changes how the industry functions from either a contract or procurement. If it changes, that's changing it from a contract and a procurement perspective. You're going to start creating to potentially an environment where technology adoption on construction is going to increase. We've always had a barrier in Australia, and it's largely driven by the unions that it's just difficult to innovate on site because as soon as you innovate on site. You're effectively taking somebody's job. So unions are obviously advocating for members, some people to have jobs and people to have more jobs. So the classic example, and people who've heard me speak before are probably bored of this example by now, but you go to the UK, there's obviously a lot more urban areas, right? So when you've got to close streets down for construction because you're upgrading a bridge or you're building a building, like you're doing some kind of building, and you've got to close down a road, we don't have a guy there with a hard hat and a high-vis jacket and a lollipop, right? Or in this case, like four or five of them. We have these amazing things called automatic traffic lights that do the job for us. Takes a human out of the element, like increases health and safety because you don't have somebody stood on the side of a road in the heat, right? We use traffic lights. Standard way of doing it. We don't do that here because you are taking jobs away from people.
Yeah, and those people get paid sometimes 100. If you want to go and get a nice job, like $100 an hour, it's a bloody good job too.
While the environment's there, make hay while the sun shines, I say. But that is one. So it's things like that that increase the cost of construction. And I've heard examples now where automated traffic lights are coming in, but you still need to employ somebody who's going to be sat in the ute with an iPad to control them.
Yeah, true.
So And it sounds ridiculous, right? It sounds like
something
you get.
Robots anytime soon. We've all seen, you know, the Tesla robots, and you know, they do amazing things. But that's the amount that a trade needs to learn and do. I'm not saying because AI has so much potential. The actual on-site work, I think for consultants, it's going to change more. I don't think we completely know what that's going to look like, because once it starts opening up, that is going to open up. And there is a lot. I'll say I'm very fortunate to talk to lots of people in the industry and different things. There's going to be a lot of automation on that side of things and what that looks like. So I think we're very much going in for an interesting 5 years. In Queensland, we're going in for an interesting, you know, build up, obviously, to the Olympics. And as you're predicting, very, very competitive market with not enough talent. Supply might be going from an international, but our biggest cost driver, it sounds like, in Queensland for the next few years, and what's going to prohibit things from being built, is actually the cost of labour and trust.
Yes. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We've seen it before when Queen's Wharf was being constructed to try and get their project moving forward. And you know, this is very anecdotal, but there were stories of like builders turning up to site on other projects and finding that their trades hadn't turned up because they were being paid cash in hand to turn up to Queen's Wharf, to go and work on that site because Queen's Wharf couldn't get the same amount of labour. And that shows a distinct difference between, say, the UK market and the Australian market. In the UK market, you've effectively got two tiers. You've got your managing contractor, and then they employ subcontractors and trade contractors, right? And the trade contractors provide the labor. So a ceiling contractor or a brickwork contractor, they will have their labor that are employed directly by their business. Here, we've effectively got three tiers. You've got your managing contractor, they employ trade contractors and subbies, but then those subbies then employ individual trades. So the guy with a dog and a ute kind of example, they employ them individually, and each tradie has got his or her own ABN.
ABN, yeah.
You've got three tiers. So those tradies, in a way, aren't loyal to a business. They're loyal to themselves and their own bank balance. That's why the unions have been so powerful, because it's individuals who are members, not companies that are members. So that creates an entirely different dynamic about how the labour market works. And labour is going to go. So like when, again, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a bit less, there's an example of like carpenters on Queen's Wharf earning $250,000 a year, right? We're going to end up in that kind of environment again, because trades that are particularly in demand, they'll almost be able to say, this is my rate. If you want me, that's what you pay.
And that's it is kind of, even though the market's quieter now, it is kind of at that point. You know, it's people just pay what they need to pay to get those trades on board. Yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be – it's thank you for all of your time and insights. It's been very, very interesting. Is there – we always sort of finish on something. Is there anything that you would recommend? We have books, podcasts, all of those types of things. But obviously, you know, is there anything else people should be keeping an eye out, particularly that you've been talking about today?
In terms of like a recommendation for a podcast or a book or something? Or
things that you listen to, and then I'll get some industry parts too.
Yeah, there's a book. I need to look it up because I can't remember what it's called, which is extremely remiss of me.
Well, you can put it in the show notes if you can't remember.
No. That's a good thing about technology these days. All I've got to do is go to Audible and I should be able to find it. And I say that, and I've just recently read Good to Great. By Jim Collins, which has been out for years, right? It's been out for at least 20 years. I think I actually listened to the audiobook, but it is so compelling for where we are in the market today and how good businesses operate, and gives you a really good example of how bad businesses operate. But Good to Great, I would recommend to anybody.
A goodie, an absolute goodie. Well, thank you. Can I just say on behalf of the Brisbane industry, thank you for everything that you have done. Thank you for all your time here. I know you're going to go back to the UK and give them a lot more of your energy and insights, and I'm sure the next phase of your life and career as well. But you've definitely made a big impact here, and I know, obviously, I'm sure lots of people have reached out to you and have been very thankful for everything you've done. So thank you very, very much.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you.